All right, everyone. Good morning. Welcome back to another episode of the Deer Gear Podcast. Today, I am joined by Dorge and back by request, Mr. Dave Murray. How's it going, Dave?
Pretty good. How are you making out?
I'm doing pretty good. Like I said, I had a fellow reach out to me on Instagram and said, please have Dave back on. So here we are.
Oh, cool.
So, Dorge, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing quite well. I wonder what they want Dave for. But Dave is a pretty cute guy. Like some of the girls I saw in one of the shows caught him. Maybe that's the reason.
I got that country charm kind of from South Jersey happening.
I asked him if he had any specific questions for you this morning, but he hasn't gotten back to me. So hopefully whatever we talk about today suffices for him. But before we get into everything that we're going to talk about today, it's been a while since we heard from you. How's things going?
Pretty good. Pretty good. I mean, just, coming off of the winter, things seem like they're starting to pick up a little bit with phone calls and stuff. People are getting, the serious ones are getting itchy now. So that's what's happened. I'm just looking forward to going on with the summer months and going into deer season.
How did last year's season end up for you?
Not too bad. Not too bad. We're pretty, it tapered off around, I'd say about end of November, early December with the, I gotta have it right now kind of deal. You get them calls that are, on a Monday, can you ship it out Tuesday and build it real quick? I mean, that's hard because it's something that I have trouble stocking one particular thing because I offer like 15 or 20 different build options. And it makes a little bit of a trouble area to just pinpoint and stock one or two types of arrow builds and a certain length. And, there's veins and somebody wants special vein colors and that whole mess.
Oh, yeah. So yeah.
It's not easy being custom.
Yeah. So before we get into today's topic, I have a question for you that I want your perspective on. And it's a topic that Dorge, Jeremy Martin, and I covered at the Harrisburg show. But I just want to get it from your perspective as well, because you have different customers than we do. So as we enter 2024, there seems to be maybe some trends that have fallen off or becoming less popular. Others are gaining traction. For you and the customers and calls that you field and the arrows that you build, what do you think is the biggest or the hardest misunderstanding or myth or trend or fad to get people away from? What's the hardest thing to convince people to change?
Oh, when you were first talking about that, broadheads came to mind.
Okay.
It's the hardest and the easiest thing to change because during the season and when they first buy a broadhead, it's a great broadhead. It's the best broadhead. And they may have good luck with it that season. But the one time that there's, a long track or they don't find the deer and, could be a shot placement issue, automatically it's the broadhead's fault. And then it becomes the easiest thing to change at that point, and they're on to another broadhead. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is, being like in my position where I basically only offer the arrow veins, some people want to maybe dip into exploring the arrow vein 3, which is great, but it's a little bit more broadhead, specific, in that instance. So, I would say the hardest thing I guess I could say is the broadhead battle. And then what I see coming out this year is, I guess, different arrow trends as far as the shaft goes from some of the manufacturers. I think they misrepresent in a sense, you don't have to spine align these arrows. It gives a misleading representation. You see one pro archer jump into, another arrow company that, I would be willing to bet that I can put it on, the spine tester that we have and pull up First Dynamic Bend and say, there it is. So you got to watch some of these trends being highly advertised and they're kind of knocking on the door of misrepresentation of what's actually going on, and you know, with an arrow.
Sure. Yeah. That specific shaft that you're talking about has piqued my interest, and I have done a lot of research on it myself just because I was like, how is this possible? And I did watch a video of a guy put it on a ram spine tester, and he was not able to find a difference.
Well, the ram, and this is to my experience with the ram and to my understanding, maybe George will probably clarify on this more in depth, that finds more or less a high side and a low side to the shaft, which could be, in speculation, the dynamic bend, but we really don't really know, because that, in my opinion, was geared more towards an aluminum shaft, where you really only had one bend in the shaft. What we find is the dynamic bend of the shaft, which, you know, after, you know, putting it on the PAP system, you get a feel for it, not so much, you know, the gauge. That's at that point where I would actually like to get the shaft itself, you know, and put it on the PAP system and say, you know, what this actually is. But it also raises to me, and again, maybe George can amplify on this, if a shaft doesn't have a dynamic bend, what is the natural bending point? Is there a natural bending point? If it doesn't have a natural bending point, is that going to be more problematic because we lose that consistency? Because sometimes the mistake ends up being the plus, and I'll refer this to arrow straightness, that you've got a 001, let's just say it is a 001, and you know that carbon is going to break down more over time, that little mistake can change more frequently or faster. So it changes dynamic bend. As far as a 005, that mistake is more dominant, but the mistake itself, in my opinion, becomes more or less the benefiting factor in the arrow build, because it'll hold longer. And I think that benefits the archer more. Like we said, I believe in one of our earlier podcasts, that, you know, we've taken 8,000 to 13,000 straightness arrows that George, you know, was first experimenting with. You know, we were able to get like sub 3-inch groups at over 90 yards with. So the straightness kind of goes out the door. But in the longevity of things, I'd rather have that 005, 006 kind of arrow, which I believe is more typical.
Yeah. So it's almost, if you can't determine how the arrow is going to bend, then you don't know what's going to happen when you shoot it.
Yeah, that's my idea.
Yeah. George, anything on that?
Well, actually, I kind of agree more. I mean, they've saved a lot of being the best. But then, of course, with the latest condition, with talking to some of the customer who should really, really long shaft, the first dynamic bend is one of the main factors. But at the same time, when you start shooting arrow that's over 27 inch long on a normal 70-pound bow, what I discover is that the system, the arrow do not bend like a fish, like we always said. They actually bend more like a snake. So it's not just one bend. But remember, the first dynamic bend is still the dominant factor. That means now you got that section of the arrow bend, but you may have two, or like in most cases, front and back of it have another bend, which is the opposite. But the first dynamic bend is still the first dynamic bend. Just like if you're a firstborn and you got two other siblings, you're still the firstborn. It do not change you.
Yeah. So before we jump off of this topic, I have a question on the first dynamic bend. And it's just a topic that came up recently at the Harrisburg show. And people were talking about whether or not they should have the first dynamic bend down or up. And if you have a drop away rest, correct me if I'm wrong, it's not that critical. It's just more or so that they all should be the same. They should all be pointing the same direction.
Well, actually, in vertical bow, as long as you got a decent arrow rest, it's not an issue. Actually, in the case of any archery equipment, as long as you got an arrow rest, you are fine. But the moment when you go into a crossbow, that's a whole different ball game. Because
of the rail.
You got the rail. So if you bend up instead of bend down in the midsection, you literally lift the arrow up, the tip up. When you lift the arrow tip up, then the rail at the front of the rail, which behaves like an arrow rest, no longer applies.
Sure.
So now you're literally bending the arrow in the midsection and the whole front of the arrow is off the rail. That's the reason the first dynamic bend is so critical for a railed crossbow. Does it? I mean, as you decrease the arrow length, it decreases the the criticalness of the first dynamic band for Crossbow, because you usually go way above the first dynamic band. But at the same time, if you say shoot a ridiculous heavy spine, does the first dynamic band matters? Well, just put it this way. If we build, when I'm building Dragon Slayer, which have this in the full form at a 32 inch, the first dynamic, the spine of the arrow is around 50, if not 50, or 25. Yes, or 25. The first dynamic band still matters.
Yeah, the arrow.
Because it's the length of the arrow.
Sure. Go ahead, Dave.
We had, I think I actually have it on my YouTube. When Dorch had sent me his cameras, I had videoed a Scorpid VTech platform, and that was, I videoed that in launch at around, I want to say the arrow was going around 380 or 390 feet per second, because it was over a 500 grain arrow. But when I videoed it, and we had a 26 inch concept built arrow, a 2.0. So it had the tube in the back and it had the tube in the front. And what I found is, and this was filmed, I believe, at 6,200 frames per second. So it was really slow. Just to give your perspective, I think your iPhone only goes, what, like 120 or 200 frames or something? Yeah, something like that. So we were able to watch, if you put it on like a bigger, you know, like a bigger screen, like a computer monitor or something, I was able to watch and see the dynamic bend flexing upward off of the rail, as compared to, you know, when we spine locate. And the other note I would make is, I think Dorge may know this too. There's an article by the National Field Archers Association, I believe that Rod White did on it, as far as the finding first dynamic bend. And I recall back then Rod White has used, you know, the PAP system on there, and through his high speed video experiences and footage, what was he done, they, when shooting the arrows, first dynamic bend consistently always flexed upwards. Of course he's bending it for that, but there was always a consistency, you know, in that. And, you know, I would add that, you know, for guys that, you know, bear shaft tune and spend that time, and, you know, I'm not saying that you can't do that for really fine tuning the arrow, but what I will say is the average hunter that works with his hands, it doesn't really have a lot of time to spare, because he's working 40, 50, 60 hours a week, you know, to try and get some time into his stand. When we go to spine locate an arrow using the PAP system, there's a huge benefit to this. They were able to put them in the ballpark. I mean, respectively, it's got the potential to shoot 2-inch groups at 60, 70 yards, you know, across the dozen. I mean, your worst arrow is still a good shot, not something where if you go to buy a dozen arrows that are not spine located, you know, you're going to maybe have half the dozen that are qualified for, you know, your squirrel that you get mad at 15 yards and try and take a poke at it. Yeah. It's going to be, you know, having like a not favorite arrow. You know, the dynamic bend, the importance of the first dynamic bend as far as how we find it, I believe, is critical to the guy who's your average guy out there, you know, working, to get him so that he's not spending 4 or 5 days trying to bear shaft tune and then refletch, and we can just fletch, find dynamic bend, fletch, and he can practice hitting bullseyes versus trying to figure out arrows.
Yeah. So one thing that we say here at Exodus, with we've never put it this way, and I'm glad that you did, but we say with cell cameras that we're selling people time. So a cell camera keeps you from having to go check your cameras all the time, and you're able to spend time doing other things because time is limited. And the PAP system is essentially the cell camera of arrows. It saves you time. It saves you a bunch of time trying to mess around with nock tuning and bear shaft tuning, and simply just get them out of the box and shoot them.
Yeah, and a lot of people, you know, including myself, I'm, you know, regular Joe Archer, you know, I probably got 100 things about my shooting technique that I don't know about. And that compounds the issue when you're trying to do something like bear shaft. Do I got too much face pressure? Do I got the right release engagement from my bow? I mean, and you know, when you, not everybody has a high speed camera. When you use a high speed camera and you film this, you get a whole different perception of like, wow, like, am I really tuning the bow good? The arrow that I think was shooting a perfect bullet hole looks like I would sell the bow if I couldn't get it right coming off of the rest that way. So I think there's a lot into what we're doing that helps dampen those issues for the average shooter. I remember George telling me when my first year in doing this, he goes, you know, we can give somebody the best pipe of shocks on their truck to go up the dirt road with. He goes, but if they drive off the dirt road, there's nothing we can do to help them. So it's still got to be within part, you know, to the shooter to still do his job to make everything that much easier.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Dor, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I think Dave hit the nail on the head. It's time. You know, I remember when the days when I'm doing consulting work, flying the last month, starting September, whatever's on the catalog, first three pages, I pretty much bought. And in my days of so busy doing consulting and also accounting and so on, I don't have time. I always believe that if I buy the best, I have the best. Gosh, it's like a fishing hoax and everything. If it is not the most expensive, I ain't buying.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty much the end of it. But as I get older and finally, you know, actually look at the situation, the end of the day, an educated consumer is the best consumer for himself or herself. If you don't know what you're doing and using price as the only gauge, I think you're in trouble.
Yep, I agree.
I
would add to that is that as far as the expense goes, you know, when people first dabble into looking at custom builds from whoever, you know, there's going to be a noticeable price difference in a sense, you know, especially when you start adding laden knocks to it and you start getting $300-$500 for an arrow build potential. People say, oh, well, that's crazy. What's happening? Well, when you buy a dozen factory arrows, you know, as I have done myself, and you get three or four arrows out of that dozen that are shootable at, say, 30 yards, not 50, not 60, not 70, maybe just shootable at 30 or 40 yards. And then you start weighing out that price. Let's just base it on that arrow that you know, there's three. I'll just make it simple. You bought a dozen arrows. You paid $150 for them, but three of them are the ones that really work. Well, you just paid $50 an arrow.
Yeah.
What is really the expense difference going into this? And you got to think, put it in perspective in mind. Some of these hunters are going on a hunt that's $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $10,000. They're going there for a few days, maybe a week. They took off work to do this. Maybe they get paid vacation. Maybe they didn't. And their whole year, their whole season drummed up to this, rest on maybe one shot that they get to have. Maybe they get the follow-up second shot. You know, they've already spent the money on gas, getting there, the trip, everything. If you had to spend another $100, $150 on an arrow build, in some cases, somebody in crossbow world, some of the factory prices of them are creeping up to where they're even competitive with my prices. When you factor in that, you know, the average hunter should really ask himself, is the custom build, do they want to put money into that just to seal the deal? My position is, why wouldn't you? It's logical, you know, to make that extra little investment, because at the end of the day, when you release your arrow and the arrow leaves the bow, it doesn't matter what kind of bow you have or anything like that, the arrow's on its own at that point to the target. And it's a matter of how that arrow is going to deliver its energy accurately to the target. And in our case, what we most profound on is invertible wind conditions, such as crosswind.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just doing mic drop and the podcast right there. That's all we need. But no, I agree. I think, and a lot of it, just not to keep harping on the time thing, but there's a lot of knowledge that you have. There's a lot of knowledge that Dorge has and has passed along to all of his certified trained dealers that the average consumer doesn't have time to learn either. So if you put your money and trust in someone that has that knowledge, you don't have to have it yourself. And that's kind of the biggest kicker with, like, you don't know what you don't know. Dorge always says that. And a lot of the everyday whitetail hunters don't know a lot about this stuff. So it's our job to know it. And we have put ourselves in the position to help those people. So I think there's a time savings all around. So the investment is quite worth it, in my opinion, as well.
Oh, it's not just that. I really truly believe that as we gain knowledge, I think that was the biggest issue for me, is that when I started Fina in 2006, I really thought I know a lot because I hunt for 20-something years. I mean, every year I spend $2,000-$3,000 all the way back. I mean, you're talking the days that I spent $320 buying a Columbia Gore-Tex Cordura jacket. Guess what? I still have that jacket. I remember that time I just ready to get married the first time. It was expensive, you know. $320 in 1992. That's a lot of money. But I still spent $800 on a fishing reel. So I can't really complain that much. Sorry. The case of money coming in, my fishing reel price is all splashing in front of me. But you know what? The thing is that there's so much not to know. I mean, just like I was surprised when I was doing the 32-inch arrow testing. I said, holy shit. Oh, sorry. It is not one band. It is more than one. I didn't really recognize it. What is the implication of it, especially on a 32-inch draw guy? Because just like, I don't know whether you heard, I got a gentleman call me. We have a literally half an hour conversation. He won a 32-inch arrow. He's shooting at 75 pound, and he have an inch and a half loop because he got a 34-inch draw.
Jesus.
And he wanted to shoot 75 pound because that's what he feel comfortable with. And he came on discussing with me over the first dynamic band with Aero Concept 1.0. I said, no. For you to work something like that without going to extreme build, because he's shooting, because he had to shoot something like a spider web or that kind of super hard target. Aero Concept 2.0 for long-term use is just not ideal. So I was suggesting using my Aero Weave 300-200, which is 200 spine on the just like a final Aero bow shaft, but it is up to 32 inch long because that's what the minimum he had to shoot. Because he said, I'm 2 inch shorter than my draw length already. I say, wait a minute, you're shooting a 34-inch draw? I said, yeah. I said, where do you find 34-inch draw? I said, yep, I got them to build for me. I said, I didn't know they make for 34-inch draw bow. He said, and then he's saying that I told him, he said he want to put a 6-inch tubing in the front, just like Aero Concept. Would that be better? I say, no. With your build like this, you're better off getting a 10.5-inch tubing in the front. And maybe a 6.5-inch on the back. I think you'll get much better. Because instead of the arrow behave like a snake with 1, 2, 3 band, it more have one left. And then your broadhead, the whole reason for this is that he was shooting field point great all year long. The moment he put on a broadhead, it was all over the place. We're talking 30 yard, 5 inches, that kind of deal. He said, I can't shoot any animal like that. I said, you shouldn't. You couldn't. Go to a smaller broadhead. Go with something like a stick trick, 1 inch. I mean, go. But he said, because he's in Idaho. Yes, he was in Idaho, and he do not want to use, he cannot use something like my spring blade. I say, if you want my spring blade, you don't have to worry about it. He say, we can't use mechanicals here. They okay. I'm not sure that it's indeed true, because a lot of people still, I still got phone calls. Well, I'm in such and such a state, I can't use lightener. I say, you know, the law changed, right? Yeah. Because, there's no state do not allow lighter nut right now. In other words, you can use a lighter nut anywhere on this planet to go and harvest a public land or private land deal. Of course, private, you can do anything. But that is where a lot of times I say, get yourself informed. Because I know some state right now, they allow a certain form of mechanical broadhead, and some straight out have limitations. So because it doesn't work on your previous mechanical product, do not mean the other one do not work in your state. So get yourself familiar with the law. Let me say, well, that's too complicated. Well, you're dealing with archery. What more complication you want to test the past?
Yeah. Amen. Amen. So at the beginning of the conversation, we talked about the difficulties getting people to switch broadheads. And a lot of that, and Dave's having that conversation with a lot of people is because of the vain choice that he is trying to offer to folks. And part of one of the things we wanted to cover today was the vain choice and speed and how veins and speed are correlated, George. So why don't you go ahead and take it away?
Well, actually, that was one of the subjects I want to discuss because that was one of the most important subject I want to talk about. If your speed is actually over 260, because if your speed is under 260, vein is really pretty minor. You can do everything you want. You can do cascade veins. You can do two veins, three veins, four veins. You can actually put some different type of veins on it. Does it? I mean, just to prove a point, you can put a vein tag and then a blazer and then an AAE on an arrow, and you shoot under 260. The arrow will shoot reasonably well. Can you believe that? What does that prove you? That proves that at low speed, the aerodynamic. First of all, there's no aerodynamics. We're talking drag only. The drag coefficient of each vein is pretty much. It's on the shape is similar. You pretty much have the same result. So that itself become a lot less critical. Your speed is not critical. Just like the shape of a car. When you drive the car down on the highway at less than 45 miles per hour, what shape of that vehicle need to be not superbly noisy? Actually, for noise, you're looking at about 35 miles per hour for the size of a car because it just got that big. So in the case of the vein, at low speed, the aerodynamic factor is actually less. But the noise factor become a much bigger deal. I'm going to ignore the broadhead for now, then focus on the vein only. Because the moment we put a broadhead with the vein, that is interdependent relationships. And that can cause a whole new section of issues. First of all, if you've got a hard vein, you expect it to more drag, expect it to have more control. I mean, just like if you want to build a paper airplane, the fact is that the harder the paper, the better it performs, the more predictable. The softer it is, the less it will perform, the less predictable. That's pretty much the same deal. Your paper airplane, the only thing that matters is the wing that you give it. In the case of the aero, well, guess what? Your veins is your wings. And like a gentleman who just sent quite a bit of detail on how he asking me on our comments on YouTube, keep on saying that if you want to shoot heavy FOC, what kind of vein can you use? I say, you still haven't told me the whole picture. What kind of broadhead you want to use? If your idea is shoot ginormous broadheads, then you need the softest, smallest vein. Even if you shoot close range.
You need the vein, the broadhead to be the control.
Correct. But then if the vein do absolutely nothing, if you really want to shoot under 20 yards, what's wrong with not having any veins? Because you think about it, if you got an arrow with veins and you got an arrow without veins and you swing it in the air, you can instantly tell the difference. If you really want a close range, super heavy FOC, that kind of deal, having no veins, having a thinner arrow, actually is not a bad thing because that's pretty much do exactly what you want to do. The product is the only thing because you don't have to fight anything. Mm-hmm. When there's nothing to fight, right? But then we move to higher speed, say starting 270, 280. Oh my gosh. Veins become more and more critical. Not just at that moment you're talking with sound. You're talking steering. You're talking with the gaining of control on the shaft itself. And the interaction of the broadhead and the vein now become more and more and more important. Because the heavier weight and the size of the broadhead, that implication on the shaft towards the tail of the shaft and was in action. Now it's not just the vein, it's the shaft with the vein combined. See, this is something that actually intrigued me because I always thought that when you have 32-inch arrows, the entire arrow would do a first dynamic bend with just like a V-shape, right? Or a very shallow U-shape. Well, then if the U-shape it tilts all the way up, where's the vein? Well, find out that no, it's not the case because it do multiples. Well, if you do multiples, then the access of the entire arrow It's actually a lot less. You say, well, if that's the case, it can't be great. You got to be great. No, it's not. Because the entire wave of the arrow become another issue. But the first dynamic band is still the most dominant. Remember, I say the most dominant, not the only, but the most dominant. There's other factors. How do I say it? Again, the more you know, the more you don't know. Because you find out what you don't know and you try to make it work. And it is not easy. Because if easy, everybody would have done it. And in so many cases, helping yourself to shoot the best you can with the speed you can manage is critical.
So at what point, at what arrow length does that start to play? Over 27 inches, you said?
I would say it's the spine and the length and the draw curve and the draw power, all of them combined.
Okay. So how much?
I would say usually it's about 27, 28, 65 pound, 20 inch draw. You're going to see that, which you know 99%, but 90% of all archers are. That's the reason if I build a test arrow, usually I build 20, 29 inch, 30, 3 inch spine, because that will fit pretty much anybody. Mm-hmm. Except Chad. I can't help that. and the last customer, but those are fine still between.
Does the addition of Arrow Concept change that at all?
Oh, significantly. Because you make the arrow a lot more predictable, a lot more manageable, and you actually significantly increase the penetration in shorter distance.
Sure.
The thinner the arrow, the worse it gets. The larger the arrow. And I mean, just like this year, you want to see the trend. This year, the trend for me is quite a few guys already buying my 300, 300, 300, 350, and 300, 400. Hmm. When you say 300, it means 300 ID.
Yeah.
They're actually buying those arrows.
Hmm.
That's a great arrow. That's a great arrow size to build with. There's a lot of components to put in. I mean, like, you know, in a 246, I think it was, what do we have, like a 14 and a 21 grain insert option. We get in the 300 area. Now we're working with crossbow kind of stuff. We can hammer in a 100 grain insert, not counting the concept tube. You're running 150 plus grain up front, you know, not counting the shaft. You know, that adds stability, you know, and weight. Technically, you know, I often refer to that as like throwing a train at a deer. I mean, that's just, you know, you're going to hit them with bricks, but that's the options to, you know, start knocking on the door for that 300 ID shaft.
Yeah, you can really enhance the structural integrity of an arrow size.
See, the structural integrity is not what I was most concerned on. It's simply the shaft dynamic efficiency. And when you start shooting a 300 spine, the I always call it the five motion of the shaft, you take care of four of them. You actually gain efficiency on how the shaft behave, conserve, and retain energy in four out of five motions of the shaft. So the energy of the shaft, and not to mention, when you start shooting, say, a 300 ID shaft in close range, your efficiency is the best. That means you have the best penetration if you want to shoot under, say, 15 feet. Because the arrow shaft recovered and ready to penetrate. And yes, the Arrow Concept give you the no matter what with Arrow Concept, even down to the 166, you got 6 inch of technically non-negotiable bend projectile instead of a projectile that start to bend on the typical node that is very high angled.
Yeah,
I know you may not see the pictures, but I hope the listener who have listened to what I talk shows, because the angle of impact with the Arrow Concept system at close range, you decrease up to 600% of the magnitude of angle of impact. Yes. Say you're going to hit animal at say 12 degree, which is ridiculous. It's not going to kill. Now it's 20. I mean 20 over 120. I mean, you say, well, 120 is technically flat. I say that's exactly, because when your arrow head flexes like this with a 120 degree swing, well, it has 60 degree to watch one side at the absolute maximum magnitude.
Yeah. So
you expect that broadhead to behave.
I had have either of you seen the video series from Lucas Palmer on YouTube.
Mm-mm.
Okay.
No.
So he did a, he's doing a series about arrows, and he did a video that's like titled "What Matters Most for Arrow Penetration." And anytime someone posts a video like that, I always think to myself, like, oh, I wonder what he's going to say. So I watched it, and his number one key, number one factor for arrow penetration is arrow flight. You have to have perfect flight. Nothing else can, that cannot suffer. Flight cannot suffer because the angle of impact. Now, he did a really interesting and really, really easy, easy to understand picture. He drew a picture of it, and then he showed you. So say, imagine this. I have a paper towel roll in my hand. Imagine it's a pool noodle, and it's way more flexible. Okay. So he took a pool noodle, and he takes and grabs the pool noodle, and he calls this part the FOC, and then this is the center of gravity, okay? And he takes it, and he tries to impact something square. And when you impact something square on the end of the shaft, it takes a lot more pressure for the arrow itself to buckle. So the pull noodle, in this sense, it's hard. It takes more pressure to get that to buckle or to fail. If you take and say that what it's hitting is a rib bone or a shoulder bone, and you hit it at an angle, the front of the arrow or the pull noodle buckles a lot quicker. So the structural integrity of the front of your broadhead or the front of your arrow is super critical when you come into contact with things when you're not impacting square. And he actually showed a few different ways to increase the front end of the shaft's structural integrity, and he mentioned Fire-Knock arrow concept in the video.
I actually have a video in high speed of an arrow concept system shot at about 20, 30 yards impacting a curved red dyed 2-liter soda bottle. And you got to think here, you know, there's I know it sounds strange because you're hitting water, people would automatically think that's soft, but you know, if you ever fell off the top of a bridge and hit the river, you're not going to make out so good, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
So there's just transfer of energy different, the displacement on water would happen totally different. So the arrow hitting, you know, especially with the Tomahawk, large broadhead, 4 millimeter thick, hits the curved water bottle, the frontal end of it, and that's concept 1.0, not 2.0, that the frontal end of it maintained very rigid, very straight in line. The energy transfer, the buckling per se, went to the, you know, the back of the arrow, which I would expect there's without the 2.0 concept system in there. You know, we don't have that stability per se, but I have that on video filmed at, I think, 5,300 frames per second of hitting a dyed liquid bottle. We've even filmed it very closely to the water bottle, to where when we see the dyed water and the Tomahawk is actually rotating within the water, causing a phenomenon called hydrodynamic cavitation, we see all these air bubbles and stuff coming out, which essentially, if that were to be a lung, we are stopping blood flow. When you stop blood flow, essentially the animal's going to stop, which is the whole
purpose. Well, I'll stop you right there. It is not stopping blood flow. It's stopping the blood from flowing. That's different from blood flow. The blood will continue to flow, but the blood that was in the path of that Tomahawk is very, very speedily turning into non-liquid.
Right.
That's the difference.
Right. You get a whole bunch of, I think Dord shot a deer where you had a double lung and then all these air bubbles and stuff were coming out of the deer. I mean, like a lot. And I've seen videos.
Well, actually, you end up with 2-inch foam. Like, yeah, I just sprayed my insulation foam into the deer.
Right. That's exactly how it looked, but red. And I've seen videos, you know, done by with other broadheads where you see it going through the liquid, like they still shot it in the liquid, and you don't see that. You hardly see anything, any kind of air bubbles versus a Tomahawk. Looks like a darn boat propeller and the water gone.
Well, it is.
So Yeah, I mean, that was pretty cool. I do have that on video. You could see actually how rigid the firing off the air concept system makes the arrow up front, which transfers into more energy directed behind the point of the broadhead. If there's any more of a chance to penetrate a deer, it's going to be with an air concept system, bar none.
Well, actually, arrow concept system is so critical, especially it enhanced significantly. I mean, if you insist to shoot a 166 or a 204 in some case, and you do not use arrow concept system, and you want to shoot an animal with heavy FOC, just for that two statement alone, you're better off just throw the arrow concept in it. I would say that person would guarantee a 300, if not a 600% improvement in penetration when you're under 15 feet.
That's very significant.
Yeah.
You're finished.
What I would add to some of the struggle, I know we're talking about, you know, issues and with veins and stuff, but maybe some of the listeners are thinking to themselves, how do I eliminate having any of these issues? And unfortunately, the fundamental of archery, of what's out there, is not to be in an entire system. We have a lot of archers that are doing to the arrow what I would say, using an analogy of a car, that they're putting, they got a car and they're putting four different size tires on the car. It's just not going to work well. Same thing with the arrow. They're trying this vane from this manufacturer, whether the vane is good or not. That manufacturer does basically only vanes. Maybe they might make a second product, or a manufacturer just makes a shaft or an insert or a broadhead. In our area, the fundamental for how we're building is to put the shooter in a complete system from point to nock. We have a system out there that we could implement for the shooter to eliminate going all down these basically experimental roads. And again, this is going right back to saving the shooter time on the watch when he's practicing that week or two, you know, before season, to get out there and be more ethical.
1,000%. Dave, I want to leave you with a little joke here. I got to make sure I'm getting to my next meeting. But so Chad and we're trying to run a business, right? So we have to kind of make some decisions that you got to give the customer what they want in some sense. And for Total Archery Challenge, it seems like real flashy arrows are the most popular. So wraps and really colorful arrows. And I designed an arrow wrap, and you know how you say wraps are for cheesesteaks and buffalo chicken?
I was just thinking that.
I made wraps that look like buffalo chicken sandwiches and cheesesteaks.
That one I may use. That I may have to get in touch with you after this.
I was going to send them to you on an arrow and be like, here's your Total Archer Challenge arrow for you.
That's great.
Yeah. So guys, thank you for joining me today. I really enjoyed the conversation. We'll have to continue this next week probably. So George, do you have any concluding remarks here?
I think they pretty much say in the way that I couldn't. I'm too much of a professor in lecturing. That's my core life. What can I say?
Sure. So Dave, if anyone has any questions for you personally, wants to get some arrows from you or whatever, where can they find you?
I got my website, vitallimits.com. If they want to see some high-speed videos, I got the Vital Limits YouTube. There may even be some hunts on there. Some of my customers, they can see. There's a couple of hunts on there with kids that are one of my favorites on there. They can go see them pick some holes in deer.
Cool. Well, you heard it there, guys. And until next time, we'll talk to you soon.
Great. See you all. Bye.